The Sunstone Foundation presents Medical Ethics, Questions for Our Time, recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel, Utah, in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
The speakers are all eminently qualified. They will address rather specific topics, so this won't be a general rambling, and we're going to ask them to observe approximately a 15 to 17 minute limit on their remarks so that we may more liberally enjoy a discussion afterwards. I would like to introduce each speaker now so that we can proceed uninterrupted. The first one will be Dr. Lester Bush, who is trained at Hopkins and the University of Virginia, has also, in addition to his MD degree, a Master of Public Health degree, and worked closely in the Johns Hopkins Medical History Institute, and is a scholar of medical history to a great extent. He also worked for the Central Intelligence Agency, and I can't divulge any more about his assignment there, of course. Dr. Lee Smith is a private practitioner here in Salt Lake City with Memorial Clinic. He is more or less renowned for his expertise in the area of paramedical or paraconventional medical treatments. He is qualified because he's the chairman of the Utah State Unproven Health Practices Committee, constantly seeking unproven health practices to chair. And he's the president-elect of Collegium Esculapium, which is a unique organization of Mormon physicians seeking to meld theology and religion with medicine. Next, Dr. Alan Rehm is a close personal friend of mine and a former associate at Stanford University who directs the, what do you direct? What is that called? It's such a fancy name. He directs the Institute of Engineering Design and Medicine. He was trained for medicine at the University of Chicago, having also received master's degrees in physiology and electrical engineering at MIT, and he is the director of cardiovascular anesthesiology at Stanford, and is intimately involved with both the cardiac transplant and heart-lung transplant program at Stanford, as well as the artificial left ventricular assist device program. Finally, Dr. Hal Cole is, again, a practicing physician, indeed a gastroenterologist here in the Valley at Memorial Clinic. He is the chairman of the Ethics Committee of the Utah State Medical Association and will more or less address those difficult questions in the ethics of the practice of medicine that have to do when a Mormon physician's religion may come in apparent conflict with the practice of medicine. Dr. Bush.
I'm impressed that there are enough people with staying power to be here for this session here at the end of 3 days. If anybody feels like over, that's perfectly all right. The question I was assigned is there a Mormon medical ethic? And in view of the late hour, I'm tempted to say if it is meant by this a code or established body of reflective literature as often exists in other religions, the answer is pretty straightforwardly no, and then just let it go with that. But actually, that doesn't mean, since we don't have such a body of literature, have a point of view on a variety of subjects of medical interest. So that's what I'm going to deal with, and then make some brief comments about what I think might emerge from there in terms of patterns on our point of view, and maybe something about an underlying ethic. As you know, leading Mormons, sometimes even the first presidency, have made explicit statements about various aspects of health and medical practice. That's been the case from the founding years of the church, in fact. Appropriate therapies, for example, were identified as early as 1831 when the Doctrine and Covenants and DNC 42 ratified the herbalism of the early Mormon leaders. This perspective on medicine was reemphasized for several decades in sermon and print by the leaders of the church. In the 1870s, to move forward, the church leadership under the emphatic leadership of John Taylor at the time commented at great length on what could be termed the ethical questions associated with abortion, and to some extent on what was then termed prevention. Early in the 20th century, Joseph F. Smith, as president of the church, led a vigorous authoritative attack against what during his presidency was first labeled nationally by its modern name, birth control. Most recently, the first presidency has issued, beginning in 1969, an unprecedented series of formal public statements on medical ethical issues. The first of these, in 1969, was, of course, the relatively lengthy statement on birth control. While there had been earlier public statements by the first presidency tangentially or indirectly bearing on medical ethical subjects, I believe that to be the first presidency statement explicitly on a subject of that sort. Obviously, DNC 42 might be considered an earlier formal statement, the one that relates to herbal medicine. And in the 1916 time frame, the first presidency had ratified essays on birth control written by leading brethren that generated a certain amount of heat in the Relief Society, and they had been asked to respond to the essays, and so they, in retrospect, said, "We agree with what was written in those essays." Not exactly the same thing, though, as a statement from themselves. After the 1969 statement, which ushered in this modern period, on birth control, came another public first presidency statement in 1972, this time on abortion. Then about 1976, there was one on homosexuality. In 1977, on artificial insemination. Then through the format of the General Handbook of Instructions, the Church next addressed in a public policy statement the subjects of sex change surgery in 1980. And finally, sterilization, unproven medical practices, organ transplants, euthanasia, and prolongation of life, and autopsies, all in 1983. That was in the 1983 General Handbook. This 1983 General Handbook was the first authoritative publication of the Church to bring together a collection of statements relating to health matters. Well, does this body of authoritative public counsel not establish a Mormon medical ethic? Unquestionably, it does represent what I'm terming a Mormon point of view, or the point of view at the time of the statements. The problem with extracting an underlying ethic from these published statements are threefold. There are three problems with doing that. First, they're not the only source of guidance from the Church on the subject, even the only source of authoritative guidance. Second, the guidance in these published statements often gives little explanation by way of underlying principles, rather emphasizing appropriate and inappropriate behavior with minimal explanatory rationale. Third, the guidance, either published or private, has not been static over time. So let me illustrate those three problems a little more fully. First, to consider the other sources of guidance. In the 20s, authoritative counsel from the first presidency on the type of issues enumerated here has invariably been communicated in private correspondence signed by them collectively or by the president alone or by the secretary to the first presidency long before any formal public statements have been forthcoming. These private prologues have extended from perhaps a year to several decades, depending on the question. Many private statements were gathered together in sort of an intermediate level step in 1974 by the then Church Commissioner of Health as a resource for LDS physicians. Mind you, these are well before they were published, in most part. In conjunction with the First Presidency, he prepared a series of brief statements on what was then labeled the attitudes of the Church towards certain medical subjects. Some of these were verbatim extracts from private correspondence. Others were edited or prepared anew. This most comprehensive collection to date in 74, again, however, received limited and only private circulation. Its most widespread dissemination came in 1978 when a number of the sections were read in various talks given during a series of solemn assemblies. Again, however, this was in a non-public forum. Ultimately, these statements have formed the basis of many of the 1983 General Handbook policy statements, 9 years after their collection in 74. Even so, the original collection from 74 includes sections on sterility tests, narcotics, vaccines, blood, experimentation, hypnosis, and some other subjects which even today haven't yet been formally published by the Church as a statement of policy. There isn't anything particularly sinister about that. The point is simply that you can't rely on a public record as sort of an exhaustive indication of what Church thinking is on a given subject. The other obvious source of guidance beyond these private authoritative instructions, it goes without saying, are the myriad statements by general authorities and general conference in their articles in church periodicals, church news editorials, and various official manuals. To say that such sources are not official is a convenient enough way of eliminating some confusion, but probably makes a distinction which cannot be supported with any consistency by church history, either in theory or doctrine. But the question of what defines a doctrine for the church, of course, beyond anything that I can handle. Whatever the case with definition of doctrine, belief, the church belief or point of view, is surely conveyed in these sources, and that's what I'm calling the Mormon point of view. In summary, then, for this first point, there are more sources, many more sources, than this handful of published First Presidency statements, which have defined even the authoritative point of view on medical questions. The second limitation, which I mentioned, was that such sources, especially the least controversial of these, that is, the ones that were formally published by the First Presidency, are generally quite sparse, as I mentioned, as to rationale. They're much more behavior or practice-oriented. At the extreme, for example, sex change surgery simply specified all the sanctions to be applied against those who were involved in such surgery, the most draconian in the history of the church, with no further comment about underlying rationale. Not that you couldn't figure one out, but none was authoritatively promulgated at the time. There was little doubt left that the church didn't think it was a good idea, but there was no statement weaving this response into our general theology. But rather than belabor this point, I'd refer you to the other statements issued by the church, especially the most recent handbook policy statements, most of which have been published in the last issue of Collegium Aesculapium's journal, and a couple articles contained there. The fact that those policy statements are generally only 10 to 20 lines long should suggest fairly clearly that there's no extensive underlying rationale incorporated into them. I might acknowledge in passing that that's not unique to the counsel we receive in the church on medical issues. It's generally characteristic of our policy guidance that it's behaviorally oriented and very brief. Now, the third problem with extrapolating from these statements, and the most important one, is that the statements, either those found in public by the church in an authoritative setting or privately, change distinctly over time. In this regard, the record on birth control is well known, with the 1983 guidance dramatically at variance in tone and substance with that found, say, in 1916. A comparison of the 1983 guidance with that first published on most medical subjects will show that this dynamic process is virtually every aspect of the counsel that's given on medical subjects. And looking over the history of the things, I extracted what I believe to be several patterns, which I believe are fairly consistent in the way we've dealt with things, and I will just enumerate them. First, is that contrary to its media image, the church, and specifically the uniquely authoritative First Presidency, often chooses not to express itself on issues with obvious ethical or theological overtones. This is especially true when the issues are extraordinarily complex or when important questions remain unanswered, which almost inevitably is the case at the cutting edge of modern medicine. Second, when the First Presidency does comment on these complex issues, the initial guidance is usually given in private, not in a formal public statement, in response to questions from those most directly involved, patients or physicians in this setting. I'm not aware of any 20th century exceptions to that. Third, the formal public statements by the church, by the First Presidency on these medical issues generally do not appear until relatively late in the public discussion. At this point, it's not unusual for individual members and local leaders to have reached independent judgments on the questions involved. That leads to some confusion, but the process isn't viewed as bad. It's only really disruptive when there has been private counsel, which is at variance with the counsel that's first issued publicly. Without going into detail, that was the case on the sex change surgery, for example. A fourth generalization is that with the passage of time, almost always there is an evolution in church guidance on specific medical ethical issues. The public phase of this evolution, once they have formally stated a position, invariably has been in the direction of greater conformity to the general medical and social consensus on the subject. This can be demonstrated in the history of the Council on Birth Control, sterilization, artificial insemination, abortion, and medicine in general, and even very, very slightly on sex change surgery. The degree of the shift is a reflection of the length of time the issue has been current, when a few years or decades, for example, and obviously the degree to which science and society has shifted. Mind you, that applies only to the public record. Let's see. Fifth, to some extent, this evolution in guidance is accompanied by the emergence of what, in retrospect, might be termed the core of ethical concerns which motivated the guidance from the outset. Not so obvious at the outset as it is as time passes. I'll come back to that in just 1 minute by way of a conclusion. Sixth, guidance which eventually is discarded in this evolutionary process, in retrospect, generally falls into one or two categories. The first is the case where a view has simply been asserted by fiat, just a flat statement that something shouldn't be done, with no effort at ecclesiastical justification. And the second type of case, much more common, I think, a particular view may have been justified originally with a sociocultural rationale which was readily identified with the scientific or social understanding of the time in which this council was originally given, and which applied much more specifically to that particular point in time, even though there's no caveat in the statement. An element of this can be identified, in fact, in most of the subjects of medical interest addressed by the church. Now, trying to move away from the more controversial or sensational illustrations of that, I can jump back 100 years to a point at which the church was making the transition from herbalism to the embracement of modern scientific medicine, and at a point in which we were advocating formally from the First Presidency sanitary measures and all the modern things of hygiene, which really transformed the general health of Mormons and Americans in general. To give you just a word on scientific context, bearing in mind that the church responded to the understanding of the day, almost 100 years ago to the year, the Utah Insane Asylum admitted a handful of people every year, and the leading cause listed for admissions to the hospital was masturbation. Okay, that was the principal reason why people were admitted to the hospital. Now, in addition to that, people were admitted for novel reading and disappointment. These are difficult concepts, obviously, for us now. There were people admitted for their insanity derived from what was termed litigation. And I guess as physicians we can identify with them. But you can see if that's where the state of the medical art was, it would be a little tricky to expect people to apply medical ethical counsel that would dramatically depart from that sort of understanding. In a more social context, church has always been concerned with the sexual responsibility that obviously pervades all this other council of its members. In the 19th century, sexual problems were believed promoted by premature development of the reproductive organs, which would follow directly from too much condiments and other stimulants. And so there's counsel against, you know, pastry and stuff of that sort, right, in church journals. I mean, again, it's a reflection of the understanding of the medicine of the day. A good illustration was the unnecessarily stimulating effect of dancing in the embrace of your partner. And as a result, there was authoritative counsel against waltzing, which persisted in the church, you know, directly from the leadership, from Brigham Young and the Quorum, for decades. And it was reinforced by letters from poor individuals, one classic of whom was a woman who was very promising in her young career, and was swept away by Arthur, a ne'er-do-well in his community, who had no promise but was the best waltzer in town. And no young lady felt she had fulfilled her evening at the dance without having waltzed with Arthur. And this poor girl recounted to the ladies of the Young Women's Journal in a letter to the editor that as a result of neglecting church counsel on that subject and waltzing excessively, she was forced to a premature marriage with this fellow and a life doomed to the lack of success that she had always hoped for. Okay, I'm not trying to debunk that. It's curious. We don't worry about that. A decade after that letter was written, the church was led by a new generation of people who had always wanted to waltz. They were facing some really nasty dances associated with jazz and music being played that wasn't written on the page. And they came out against a whole series of dances that I'd never heard, but suggested that the only appropriate style of dancing was in the waltz position. And you suddenly had instruction in waltz and mutual and official waltz contests and mutual and even an official MIA waltz. Okay, the transition that I'm suggesting, though, was a societal one. People had the same problems nationally in the U.S., and so you can't really gauge counsel on social issues in that context as being relevant in specific detail to what we have now. The same is true in other medical concerns. Okay, that was the second type of discarded counsel. Finally, the seventh thing that emerged from the past is that when the core beliefs themselves are changed, they're usually esoteric doctrinal considerations that have been modified by the advance of science, where they thought they understood something well enough to be absolutely sure that something could or could not be the case, and science simply demonstrated that they were wrong. For example, there just isn't any context within early thinking within the church for cell cultures in which a cell is removed from an individual and grown in a dish and remains viable and reproducing regularly for 20, 30, or 40 years after the person has long since died and, you know, gone to their intermediate life after death. Those kinds of considerations are unfathomable to religious leaders of all denominations, and their theology in the 19th century simply didn't make provision for the fact that a cell could be alive independently of its parent organism. Okay, I said that with the passage of time, some core beliefs tended to emerge. What do I think they are? Well, I'll tell you what appears to be the case in this concluding minute. The council, at least as it relates to these reproductive-related ethical issues, which are the principal ones on which the church feels called upon to comment, are, one, the centrality of marriage and children. That theme persists regardless of the change in the specific council. Two, the overriding importance of maintaining family harmony and stability. Okay, that is always there. Whether they understood the word of wisdom in a sophisticated way, like perhaps we do now, or perhaps they didn't 100 years ago, whether they were concerned about sex pre-delivery and pregnancy, was always a concern in their mind about family harmony and stability and protecting the health and well-being of the mother, the child, and what they were calling tabernacles to be. Again, all their counsel varies, but the goal was the same. Their understanding of what would have accomplished that change. The preservation of free agency and personal accountability, always there. Okay, free agency and personal accountability. When they reach the point of making a judgment and say you can't do something, I'm sure that's with some difficulty because they think there's an overriding problem. Occasionally they'll fall back from that, as they have on birth control. But in falling back, they don't absolve the members ever of the personal accountability that's involved in the decisions that need to be made. Those principles are always there. The total unacceptability of decisions based on selfish rationales. They always reemphasize that. So I think in conclusion and summary, you look at two things. We do have a Mormon point of view. The Mormon point of view demonstrably changes over time. Conveniently, it changes over time. We believe in continuous revelation, context change. We change in response to changing context. It's happened historically. I think that I would be foolish to suppose that it wasn't going to happen in the future. So I think our point of view, our specific behavioral recommendations are going to change in the future as science progresses and society changes. The core things, which we would call the Mormon medical ethical principles, have not changed, but they're not the things that are talked about in the statements. They're the things that are behind the statements, the principles that seem to underlie those things, and I feel equally confident that those things will remain the same when somebody assesses the thing in another 50 years. Thank you.
The topic which I've been assigned has to do with the issue of quackery And the title which I was given was Why Are Mormons So Susceptible? I assume that that's a given by the person that assigned the topic, by the fact that you probably know several people in your ward or vicinity or perhaps yourself who are very interested in new and unusual methods of medicine. Let me put on this, you may not see that well, I guess, but just by, there are lots of studies, first of all, let me say that there are lots of studies that would document that Mormons are indeed susceptible, more so than usual, to quackery. I'm not going to enumerate those because we've done so in other places, but this picture of the Orem 54th Ward from last night should speak for itself. We need to define, perhaps, just for a second, something about quackery. The dictionary would say something like it is the either fraudulent or ignorant, that is, unknowing use of dangerous or unproven or disproven methods for medicine. And I would add that particularly in our environment, where most people are not doing it fraudulently, that it has an element of an enthusiastic, incautious promotion of an unproven or disproven kind of method. Now, why is it an issue of ethics? The fraudulent part kind of speaks for itself. But what about the unknowing enthusiasm that we sometimes see? Ethics, if we really boil it down, is to find out what the good is and how to get the good. Okay, in the case of medicine, the good is health. And that has been well defined as not just the absence of disease, but well-being, feeling good, physically, spiritually, emotionally, psychologically. So the good and how to get the good, the methodology that's involved. Why is there such a genuine fervor today for alternatives to what would seem to be orthodox, scientific, rational kind of medical practice? Why is there such genuine religious fervor even among the Mormons? We can turn the lights on, if you will. I'd suggest... a little outline here for some reasons that I see. Better take that. Basically, I'm going to discuss this under three categories. One is that there is now a historical need, and by and large, it's very similar to the historical need that occurred 150 years ago, and we'll take a look at that. Secondly, receptivity among Mormons to testimonials and a certain antipathy to science, which has developed over the years. And finally, the core philosophical issue, freedom of choice. The freedom of choice issue is that which gets unusual practices through all of the legislatures and the National Congress. Now, what I would like to do is take a look at this historical part for just a moment. I'm not going to detail it. Lester has summarized it very nicely. But only put this up because I want to make the point that what we're seeing now is a recycling of American medical history of 150 years ago. And why 150 years ago is important is that's where we came from as Mormons. Historians would tell us that cultural patterns of a group are largely influenced by the attitudes of its founding fathers. And 150 years ago, what we saw was a revolt against orthodox medicine. Now, why the revolt? Because it was bad medicine. This is a pre-scientific era. People were being hurt. It was a form of quackery. The orthodox medicine was the enthusiastic promotion of disproven and unproven methods. It was quackery, by that kind of definition. And there was a revolt against it when it became evident, and we won't detail that just now. Okay, so... that was the reason for the revolt. What happened as the result? What did the revolt consist of? Number one, they said, if you can't trust what the docs are doing, we've got to find something else. And first of all, if you can't trust the treatment of disease, let's prevent it. And there was this huge movement that swept the country called Popular Health Reform, a religious spin-off in many regards from temperance movement, which had to do with how to prevent illness. And some of the tenets will be very familiar to you. Lots of grains, not very much meat, avoid the five poisons, which were coffee, tea, alcohol, tobacco, and opium, and so on. And I think that an excellent case can be made that the word of wisdom, revelation, came in response to Joseph asking questions about, is this stuff legitimate? And a number of the tenets of popular health reform were confirmed. A number of them were not mentioned in the word of wisdom. And in fact, the founder of popular health reform, Sylvester Graham, died malnourished because of some of the funny things that he was teaching. A very legitimate response to what was perceived as an insufficiency of the current medicine. Second revolt constituent had to do with alternative methods. And there was a whole host of them. Many of the unusual practices, what we would call quackery today, come from new ideas as to how to treat disease from that very period. And trying to get rid of controls. Medical licensure was done away with in every state legislature but one in America in those days. All practitioners of any type that treated illness were called doctor. This was a Jacksonian free choice era. Okay? You ought to be able to do whatever. You can't trust the regular docs. His methods as good as any other. So you hit all kinds of doctors of naturopathy and chiropractics, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those were the constituents. What was the response of medicine? A very healthy thing occurred. Medicine became scientific at the end of that period. Around the 1870s, they began to say, well, let's find out what is true and what works, and applied scientific method and statistics for the first time. And we had the opening of what we've seen with this great era of scientific medical advancements. Now, what happened, however, as we became so hooked on documenting what works, the old method of treatment, what did you treat before the scientific days? It was the art of medicine. It was the support and the hope and all of the things that the placebo effect engenders, which is very real and which you can document scientifically, that there is healing effect in helping a person to believe that he will get well, in giving him hope. Okay? And the alternatives, even today, are better than that, at that art of turning people on, than are the scientists. Well, what are we seeing today? Maybe I ought to digress just for a moment. Lester mentioned that once medicine became scientific, the old statements, and mind you, the advice during this period of the prophets of the church, Joseph Smith, many apostles, Brigham Young in his earlier days, was stay away from the doctors. If you're sick, go to the Lord for your healing, the prayer of faith, and the elders. And if you don't have enough faith to be healed, then use mild herbs that you can do yourself. Okay, that was the position. Excellent advice in that period. What better advice? Now, once scientific medicine came in, however, and things began to be documented, what was safe and what was effective, Brigham Young himself changed his attitude, and the changes that Lester described occurred, and the church became pro-Orthodox. Mormons today can pull up all those old quotes, and if you don't, if you trust Joseph Smith, the prophet and inspired man, he says, stay away from the doctors and use the herbs and the prayer of faith, and all of that is used to get Mormons today to feel a certain antipathy for scientific medicine. Not real. You see, it's kind of a fundamentalist issue. The prophet said it back then. It can't change. The changes today are just sort of an adaptation to the social changes. It is the sort of notion that holds some people in making it a religious issue to stay with alternative methods. However, now notice what happens today in our own time. We're seeing a revolt against Orthodox medicine, the alternative movement. That's big, not just among the Mormons, all around the country. And why? There's some good reasons. I've listed a couple of them up there. It's too costly. Secondly, physicians are not very good at the art. They don't relate to their patients well. They don't take the time, all those issues. And lots of studies have shown that the reason people go to alternatives is because mainly those humanistic issues are lacking in the healing process. Well, what does it consist of today? Prevention. Does that sound familiar in our own time? Docs don't know about prevention is the cry, although I think they do. Lots of alternatives. Many of them are just a regeneration of the old alternatives and trying to decrease controls, getting rid of the laws. Let me give you an example. Right now, in the Congress of the United States, a bill has been introduced, written by a Mormon lobbyist in Washington, D.C., and introduced by a Mormon congressman who he encouraged to introduce, called the Foods Are Not a Drug Act of 1985. And what the act is to say that anything that can be considered a natural product and thus a food should not come under food and drug laws that requires you to prove safety and effectiveness. Now, most of you know that half of the medicines we prescribe come from natural sources. Opium is an herb. Cortisone came from herbs. Aspirin came from herbs. There are many drugs. Some of our worst poisons come from herbs. That would fall under this act, and if it's considered an herb, it would be called a vegetable and a food and would not require laws, would fall outside the laws, which now require safety and effectiveness. I hope you can see a Pandora's box opening up with that kind of notion. But attempt, again, to get rid of the controls that say what the rules are as to what's legitimate. I think that I see some real benefits, just as 150 years ago or so, 100 years ago, in medicine's response. We are now seeing science being applied to find out how to decrease costs and at the same time maintain the best quality. There's never been an incentive to do that before. The incentives in the past were the patient comes in and says, "Doc, do everything," and the doc says, "Yeah, I've got lots of things in my bag here that we can try." And there was no incentive to try to keep it down. Now there are lots of incentives and studies being run to find out what can be done to lower costs safely and effectively. That's going to be a positive benefit. Secondly, research on genuine prevention. What can nutrition really do? There's a renaissance in nutritional research going on. So that's going to be a positive benefit. But again, using scientific method to find out. And there is the beginnings, very clearly, in the medical education community of how to educate the humanistic qualities in physicians so they can start to use the healing effects of that relationship more powerfully. Now, that begins to introduce some interesting ethical problems for the physician. For example, if it is healing... Well, let me give you an example. Not too long ago, I was at a little get-together with some old high school friends, and one of my best friends and his wife came down from Washington. She has multiple sclerosis. She wasn't doing well under usual therapies, as many people with MS don't. She decided to go down to see a well-known quack, fraudulent type quack, who's been convicted a number of times in Las Vegas. Went down... he turned her on to a massage program and some other things, herbs, and she began to feel better. MS will do that. MS, lots of symptoms, it goes into abeyance and comes back. I don't know whether it was that or whether his thing worked. I don't know. But nevertheless, she came back with a religious testimonial, a fervor, if you will, that how wonderful this was and how good she feels and that she's getting better and she had this hope. Now, if you think that in that moment I was either going to destroy the reason for the reunion or turn off her hope by saying, "No, wait a minute, let's take a look at the studies and look at the data here, and what you have, you see, doesn't really work, you just think it worked." If you think I'm going to do that, you're crazy, because her hope itself is a very important part of the process. There's a little ethical dilemma here. What quackery thrives on is giving that false hope. When I say false, using something that can't be shown to really work, but the hope itself works. Now, how far does a physician go in giving false hope in order to create, turn the patient's own bodily healing processes on? And again, that can be documented that that works. That gets down to an issue of something like this. What we see in quackery is at the heart of medical ethics, I think, and in fact, core gospel principles, because we see the classical ethical conflict between what's called deontological ethics, that is, duty-oriented, rules-oriented. Doing what's right is doing your duty, and doing what is prescribed as correct and good. Okay? And teleological or utilitarian ethics, that is, ends-oriented ethics. What is good is what brings the greatest good, greatest good for the greatest number, I think was one way it was stated by Bentham. And pragmatism. Now, that's a classical conflict of ethics. And some of you fall in your highest value in one of those two camps. Now, let's take just a look for a minute at medicine, for example. Science is very rule-oriented. To prove something's right, you have to use clear-cut methodology that the rules prescribe. Controlled studies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? On the other hand, the alternatives in medicine say, boy, you guys get so hung up on all of your studies and things that you can't see the forest for the trees. What we want is health out there. And I know in my heart a way to get health. And I don't care about the rules, I know it. And I would be unethical to not use this method that I know works, okay, by inspiration or some other feeling. A case in point, we have a fellow who's coming for our committee next week to explain some of his methods. This is an MD. Explain some of his methods for the data as to why he is making literally a fortune on sublingual desensitization for allergies and treating everything as allergies, when the literature, it seems, wouldn't quite support that. We've asked him to come up and present this data, and I can't say it doesn't until I hear it. Now, he would say, because I've used it, it may not be the standard of medical practice, but I believe in it, and I've seen it work myself, among my patients, okay, without studies. He would feel unethical in not using everything that he feels would help his patients. But the medical community would feel that it's unethical to make a profit from something like that until it's shown, until you really show it works to everybody, where we can agree. It's not ethical to make money on those people. Sure, you can set up a research study and you can have good controls and do it, but what about make profiting, you see, before you go through the process of proving it? Can you see the conflict there? It's a basic conflict. If we were to move over, it's the same conflict you see in LDS people with Richard Paul's iron rotters versus Liahonas. You know, you hold to the rules and do what's necessary versus being guided to that end out there. Deontologically oriented will want to have tight central controls. Those that are ends oriented will want to have decentralized kind of controls. That applies to laws in the government regarding medicine and what you can use for healing people. Okay. Now, let's maybe just use a couple of examples. Is it ethical? See, if someone down here says, my herbs heal people, the law currently says you can't use them unless you prove it. But I know they work. Okay. I've got this gut feeling and some testimonials that make me feel that way. Why shouldn't I go around the law? See, it's an end justifies the means. Okay, I'm going to say they're not really drugs, even though they have lots of drugs in them, lots of dangerous drugs in them. I'm not going to call them drugs, I'm going to call them foods to get around the law so that I can get the end that's so necessary and important. Okay, you see that kind of notion? Is that ethical to do that? Or another one might have to do with I've got my secret method, and that's characteristic of quackery. I've got this method. Nobody else knows about it because it hasn't been published. Is it ethical to profit, again, from something that I know and I'm not willing to share with the rest of the community? See, the ethics of medicine would say, boy, if you've got something that's that great, you share it with everyone. You want to heal as many people out there as possible, not just those that you can make money from. Okay? And in fact, we'll cart you off to a Nobel Prize for your great discovery if it really can stand up under scrutiny of science. You see, in science, it works. Let me move on, because of time, to the last issue, that of free choice. Oh, maybe before I do, I should show you one other interesting, fascinating paradox to me in this whole thing. And this extends far beyond quackery. When I said it gets to the heart of, you know, religious issues we're talking about in these seminars, often we will lump people into conservative or liberal categories. And here we're talking about, again, free choice. Do you have the right to do anything that you want, or don't you? Do you have a central body telling you what you can practice? Notice this fascinating paradox. Conservative people, politically, the ideal has to do with decrease in central control and individuality and free choice. You see, that's the argument among those in the alternative world, politically. And yet, within the church, it seems like it's that conservative group of people who are the most rule-oriented and central control-oriented within the church. And on the other hand, those who would consider themselves liberal politically, and liberality has to do with, you know, the government's responsible morally to take care of the poor and so on, and to enforce that. There are rules that make you be liberal, socialistic kind of ideas. In the church, that same group of people politically want to get rid of central controls and want to do their own thing and have individuality. That's always been a fascinating paradox to me. A talk that was given not too long ago, a couple of weeks ago, the Sunstone talk about the Ernest Wilkinson thing at BYU, illustrated that, where the ideal has to do conservatively with this decreased central control and freedom, and yet despotic methods used to do it. Now notice, there's a difference here. Remember, ethics has to do with what is the good and how do we get the good. The ends, the value, and the methods. And people apply different philosophies to the two. It's an important idea that we've got to come back to. In medicine, the conservative medically sticks to the rules. You do what's you know, the prescribed procedure says, whereas the liberal says, oh, gee, we don't have to go through all those tests and stuff. If I treat him with an antibiotic, he'd probably clear up. Save him money. Okay? Okay. Now, let me just say a couple of things about this important free choice issue, because it is the crux of what fuels the fire of this emotional feeling. It's the rationale that's used to justify it. Free choice is at the heart, in my mind, autonomy is at the heart of what the gospel is designed to produce in man. One time I analyzed four, what I thought were the four ultimate values of what God wants to try to produce in us with the gospel, and one of them was responsible free will. Now, should people then be able to have free choice to go out and do anything they want to medically? If it's my body, is the argument, why can't I treat it any way that I want to if I've got a disease? And mind you, that very sense of control has some healing power. I think the answer lies in the fact that the value is not just autonomy and free choice, it is responsible free choice. All right? The more freedom, the more responsibility. And both schools of ethics, both the duty type and the end type, agree that autonomy is an important ethic on which we need to operate. And medicine's moving more that direction. That is, instead of the paternalistic doctors telling you what needs to be done, he explains what the possibilities are and joins with you in the decision. We're moving greatly that way. Nevertheless, all schools of ethics say that autonomy does not apply when others can be harmed or when the patient is not in a position to truly be autonomous. Now, let me explain what I mean. If you have cancer and you want to get a cure, and you go down to your doctor and he says, I will use these chemotherapeutic things and radiation, and you'll be sick for a couple of months, and we've got a 50% chance of cure based on studies. And you go over to your a neighbor who's a guy you like and trust from your ward, and he says, listen, don't got to go down there and get burned and poisoned. I've got a guy over here that can treat you with Laetril and some herbs and some acupressure, and I guarantee you, I've seen this in members of my family, I can guarantee you that 90% cure with your kind of cancer and no side effects. Okay, that's the pitch. Now, that none of that is scientifically validatable, okay? But nevertheless, there's a testimonial from someone he believes and this hard scientific doctor down here. Is that man really free to make that choice? You see, he is exceptionally vulnerable to exploitation. And the whole notion about laws, drug laws, that require proof of safety and effectiveness is that the right to freedom from exploitation and from the right to freedom from personal harm is a greater right politically than is just the right to buy and sell anything that you irresponsibly want to buy and sell. Okay? So, again, it comes back to the issue of responsibility. If I wanted, yesterday we heard this wonderful analogy with the LA Raiders about dominance of the front line. Those of you in that section, if I wanted to play tight end for the LA Raiders, I might be free to do that. I would love to be free to do that. But you see, what I have to do before I can is, number one, prove that I have developed the capability to do it. And secondly, demonstrate that I'm as good as I say I am. And then I can be free to do it. And that's the same thing that applies to the methods of medicine. All we're asking is people show that they're as good as they say they are with their methods. Okay. Now, in conclusion, how do we resolve these dilemmas of these two different kinds of ethics? Carlisle Hunsaker and Eugene England and others have written that one of the real joys of life has to do with resolving what seem to be complementary opposites. See, both of them have good points. And the resolution of that may lie in something like this. I have a partner over here, Hal Cole, who's always been an interesting study to me. He doesn't know this. Hal is one of the most ethical guys that I know. That's why he's the chairman of the Ethics Committee. Hal is very rule-oriented with regards to methods. He does what's right and correct. At the same time, he's very ends-oriented when it comes to things like ordering tests for his patients, so on. He does what's minimally necessary to get the end that he wants. Okay? There's a resolution there in using, I think, the rules for the methodology to find out what the facts are and ends with regards to what result we want to get ultimately. There is power in the scientific knowledge, but what to do with that knowledge is a very teleological thing. How to use it appropriately is, I think, where teleological ethics come in. You see, there's a resolution. They're both right, used appropriately. Well, I'm going to stop that point, except to say I think that this one final thing. Many have wondered if this criticism by humanistic influences on the scientific method, this great skepticism of science that we're seeing, might lead to a decline in what has become the method that brought us the modern age. I don't think so. I think what we're seeing is a going back now to use scientific method to find out what humanistic principles can really do, and it will be a very positive, complimentary resolution. Thank you.
Well, you've heard, I think, two talks that certainly support the thesis that I wanted to express. And I think perhaps the best way to describe what I'm going to try to do with you is to now offer you a case study. And the case study is going to be organ transplantation, using hearts as the example, because that's where most of my personal experience has been. And what I'd like you to do is I try to travel through some of these scenarios now is to deal with this in a more subjective way and try and put yourself in the place both of the person who might be undergoing such a procedure. As the LDS patient that we had several weeks ago was obviously struggling with this, and also what you would do if you were one of those who was charged with deciding how and under what circumstances such things might be allowed and under what circumstances they might even be endorsed. Now, you perhaps should know a little bit more about my background. I started out in life as an engineer, and then I went to medical school. Because of this, I got involved in the artificial heart program just 2 years after it was founded in 1967. And at that time, the National Institutes of Health, which was concerned with funding all of the medical research in this country that was primarily funded by our government, had no ethical position. And I can remember meeting with the General Counsel for the NIH to review the problems that we had to address. And in fact, my superior, a very rigid Quaker named Frank Hastings and a very humanitarian person, became so concerned about this that we ended up diverting a substantial portion of our budget to build facilities to test these devices to assure that they reached ethical standards. And one of them was built here at the University of Utah. Later, because of this, I got interested in the device regulation process and ended up having to testify before Congress on behalf of some of the interests that were concerned there, and then chaired an FDA committee where, again, we wrestled with this issue of classifying devices to decide whether or not, at a government level, we were going to withhold the ability for people to use them freely and under what circumstances. And then finally, in returning to Stanford, we wrestled with this again in the context of healthcare delivery. I think the issue of cardiac transplantation is a superb one to take up at this point because we don't have to go back 150 years in the cycle that was just alluded to. The whole cycle in cardiac transplantation has taken not much over 10 years. And in Utah, it's my impression that, in fact, there's been a considerable change in dialogue in just the last 2 or 3 years, perhaps related in a very substantive way to the discussion that was provoked by the experiences with Barney Clark. Now, what I'd like to do is to just quickly run through the kinds of problems and attitudes that you try to deal with when you try to solve this kind of a problem, where you have a specific issue you have to address. And it seemed to me that the place you start is with that word ethics. I have a long shelf in my office with books that are devoted to this subject, and still when I go back to the dictionary, I find this an uncertain topic. The Random House Unabridged offers three basic definitions: a system of moral principles, the rules of conduct of a particular group, as medical ethics, and that branch of philosophy dealing with values relating to human conduct. Now, I submit that what I'm about to do is to deliberately muddle all three and talk without being clear about the distinction between principles, rules, and philosophy. And in deference to my colleagues, I submit that this may be the only way to begin to tease a few threads out of this that we can deal with in a substantive, specific, concrete way and abstract something from it as well as solve a particular problem. Now, my personal lexicon breaks it down in three ways. And the first one is, what does it do to the individual involved? The second one is, what does it do to other people who have a right in some sense, in some social sense, in what goes on? And I have a third category, theological. Theology, in my view, our theology deals with all of this, but let me reserve today for the theological classification those things that don't easily crop up in the other discussions, but which those of us who have strong religious beliefs must deal with, must face. Now, when you think about it from the individual's point of view, that first one, it really seems to come down to two things. One is the quality of life for the individual. If this thing is done, is it going to be good for them or bad for them? Is it going to be something that's going to improve the quality of life? And then how do we define that? That suddenly gets to be very difficult. Is it the ability to do? Is it the ability to be mobile and active? Is it whether or not you're free from suffering or pain? Or is it because if this is done, it would permit you to accomplish a duty? If you're a parent with young children and you know that in your absence that things are not going to go well, and with some considerable suffering and a heart transplant, you could provide that care for a few more years, is this providing a type of quality of life which would justify that procedure? And those who read the Deseret News last night, perhaps there's an even more interesting aspect to this. What about those who are not old enough, at least in our formal society, to give informed consent? What rights do they have, and under what circumstances should we offer this kind of therapy to them? We're doing it. And that's what happens. If we don't address those issues, they happen anyway. And then there's this issue of experimentation. A lot of literature that comes across my desk that's very hostile to one side or the other of this argument revolves around this issue of experimentation. Now, physicians are familiar with the comment that it's no accidents that we refer to it as the practice of medicine. But it's certainly important for patients to realize, too, that every encounter between a doctor and a patient involves practice. That is, you not only expect to solve that patient's problem, but you expect to learn something that means the next encounter will go a little better. And perhaps the unspoken contract between a patient and a physician is that we accept this risk to ourselves, this element of experimentation, if you will, in return for the benefits that we derive from the many, many, many people who preceded us. Now, Robert, if you could show the first slide there, we can clothe this with a feeling of emotion, perhaps, by looking at some of the objects you deal with. This first picture is a picture of what our house staff refer to as a bucket heart. We now do cardiac transplantation by excising the heart at the hospital where the donor is located, flying it via a Learjet to our hospital in salt water and ice, and then implanting it. And this is a heart that's freshly arrived in the operating room. Now, this catches a certain emotional flavor, doesn't it? It's science, and it's a little sterile, and there's no personality to it. On the other hand, there's an element of structure and discipline and the implication that somebody knows what they're doing. Next slide. This is a patient who received such a heart after his transplantation. I remember in my own experience being very negative initially about cardiac transplants, and it took me some years to realize it was because in my environment, as a cardiac anesthesiologist in the hospital, I saw those with complications. And when I went down to surgery clinic at the behest of the surgeons one day to meet some of those who were coming back who went the other way, who went out into the world, it was a real surprise to me to realize how attitudes had changed. The next slide. And this is the last one. What this illustrates, I think, is an interesting point, and it has to do with acceptance. I think my leash has been shortened. What it has to do with is acceptance of a technology and what we really use to judge. And if you look here, you can see two figures here. Along the bottom are the years from 1967 to 82. And going up the side is the number of heart transplants done each year. And you notice that the first years there was enormous enthusiasm and they were done all over the world. And then with the terrible success rate, the worldwide experience fell almost to the lower curve, which was what we were doing at Stanford. And for about 10 years, that was almost it. Starting in about 72, worldwide activity picked up a little bit. And then as you can see there in about 1977 or 8, suddenly things took off again. And Stanford went from being a center in which almost all of the cardiac transplants were done into which now a very small and diminishing fraction of them are being performed. And what happened was that a dedicated group there who were committed to this and wanted to prove it worked away until they reached a level of success that crossed over this invisible threshold where people said, this is now a therapy that we feel is ready to offer to patients. And it began again to be adopted in centers that previously had nothing to do with it. Now, this isn't a defense of cardiac transplantation, if we can have the slide off and the lights up again, so much as it is a point in how our ethical position changes. Because if we perceive something as not working very well, we're much more likely to refuse to accept it and invoke ethical grounds than we are if we see it as something which is working and accepted and viable. The discussions that I hear about ethics and transplantation now are vastly different than they were in those mid-years of the 70s, when we knew very well that we were getting successes that were reasonable, but that the experience in other centers was predicated on what they remembered from the late 60s, and they regarded it as a highly risque, highly dangerous, quote, unethical operation. So the certain element of rationalization comes down. And then you have these social issues. What about the donor? We don't talk about that very much. If it's a hair transplant, you may be your own donor if you were the patient. If it's a kidney transplant, you can take it from a living person, and there were ethical issues that were addressed in great detail there. But in the case of a cardiac transplant, there's only one heart, and someone must die in order for a heart to be available. Norman Shumway, the surgeon at Stanford who pioneered this procedure, voluntarily exposed himself for prosecution for murder in about 1976 in order to help resolve this issue. And it's an interesting story. A man had assaulted another man and shot him. And the man was at that time considered to be dead by the standards of that court in that time. But the defense attorney for the man who had committed the assault said, "This man is not dead. His heart is still beating as certain other bodily functions are continuing. And if Dr. Shumway takes that heart, he will be the murderer, and my client will hang for it." And so the court heard the case and came to the conclusion, as I'm sure is evident in hindsight, that in fact the patient was already dead. And out of that and some other cases at that time came the concepts of not only the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, which made it possible for people to will their bodies in a more, or portions of them in a more uniform way, but also a definition of death that people began to feel comfortable with, and just the way the church has gone from private communications to a more formal and public position. But Larry Niven, the science fiction author, wrote at great length about organ leggers. And he saw a society in writing some years ago in which organs could be so valuable and transplantation so effective that the supply wouldn't reach the demand and society would change the rules in order to make them more available. And I remember that one example he used in his stories was a death sentence for repeated traffic violations. Lest you laugh too hard, let me point out that the current dean of the Harvard School of Public Health has proposed significant changes making it easier to acquire organ donations, including involuntary donation in the event of death. This is a real concern, and I think it's a tribute to our society that in the transplantation field, to my knowledge, there have been no serious accusations of an inappropriate death associated with transplantation. And it's certainly my fervent hope that that situation can continue into the indefinite future. Now, the last problem, the problems in dealing with others, this second group, ourselves, others, and then God, is cost. First the donor issue, then cost, and then finally innovation. And I submit that the cost issue is frequently the one that drives ethical discussions, perhaps inappropriately. I first became aware of this when I was at the government level, and I found that many high-level economists were seriously suggesting that the way to control expensive therapies was to make them unavailable, and that the whole issue of triage to determine who merited a therapy and who didn't was impossible to solve in a democratic society, and the real solution was to withhold the therapy. I can assure you that those decisions which were made in the early 70s are reflected in the policies that are going into effect now, 10 to 15 years later. And one of the things we have to decide is whether we want to accept that point of view. The Russian argument might be, is it self-amortizing? If you're operated on and receive a heart, can you generate enough income to pay for that heart you receive? If the answer is yes, you receive it. If it's available, if the answer is no, you haven't made the break-even point and you don't receive it. Now, that may be too harsh for our society. It may be certainly too harsh for our church. But what if that heart costs $5,000, $10,000, $500,000, $10 million, or $100 million? You know in your heart that there's a point where we would withhold therapy simply because allocating those economic resources to one person would withhold worthwhile and needy activities to others. And thus, there's an ethical concern there that we have to deal with, or those around us will deal with it by default, because in the end, the dollars are limited, and those choices have to be made, whether they're made consciously or not. This element of cost comes back into the issue of innovation. Most of you, I think, have heard the word Luddites. Ned Ludd lived in the 18th century. He had a set of followers that became very well known between 1811 and 16. They believed that the rapid industrialization that was going on then was destroying jobs, and their response was to destroy factories. In the short term, they were right. In the long term, they were completely wrong, because replacing man labor with machine labor was certainly a freeing effect. Yet there are many today who have the same problem with innovation, and they say the first transplant or the first artificial heart doesn't work very well, and therefore it's a failed technology. The blunt facts are that no successful technology has ever worked well the first time around. The first Wright Brothers plane is useful only for museums. The first pacemaker and the second and the third were utter disasters. And in fact, it's a very useful argument in retrospect, but it probably doesn't help us very much at all in terms of sorting out this kind of question at the time you'd really like to sort it out, when it's a new therapy and you're considering it for yourself or others. And so the great problem with innovation and technology comes back to, in my feeling, you can't solve this by invoking those kinds of blind rules. You have to come back in the end and be a procedural person, an operational person, a practical person. And out of that experience, test those abstract rules. And if they work, you can begin to formulate an abstract rule. And if they don't, you'd better go back to the drawing boards. C.S. Lewis, many years ago, in talking about love, talked about the lowest, the physical form, and the highest, agape. And he pointed out that in religious experience, when one started at the highest level and dissociated it from the lowest, one could have terrible travesties. The Crusades, massacres. I think the same thing is true here. And so we have to come back to this operational level. Now, where does it break down? I think in the theology, because that's a spot where it's very convenient to argue those emotional issues that you can't easily prove. And so, for example, we talk about natural. Now, those of us who have worked with the FDA have realized that natural is a word you can't define. Those who operate health food stores usually know the fact. It seems unclear that the public as a whole has realized it. And if you want to test that assumption, try and decide what is necessary to do in order to buy a naturally grown carrot. When does it become processed? And is the fertilizer still fertilizer after it's passed through a horse? Is it still fertilizer after it's been sun-dried? Is it still fertilizer if it's been dried in a furnace? At what point does it become unnatural? And when we talk about prosthetics, you see, the sense of organ transplantation becomes unnatural, and then you say, well, why is it? And it becomes suddenly a very difficult discussion. Well, there's a medical word, prosthesis. The prosthesis is something that is defined as an artificial part added to the body to supply a defect, or the word for the part itself. But clothes are prosthetics, aren't they? Are clothes unnatural? Well, they certainly don't seem to be, and there are certain garments, at least, that we wholeheartedly support. Shoelaces, what about when we get to eyeglasses? Contact lenses. Well, maybe part of unnatural is the invasive aspect. But what happens then when we go to false teeth, artificial joints, pacemakers, artificial hearts, artificial organs? Well, maybe we can solve this by returning to pure definitions. Maybe it's the implantation of something that's living. Well, you've still got a problem. You know, the Nobel Prize was given almost 80 years ago, 70 years ago, for the ability to cross-match blood, which enabled blood transfusions. Blood is considered by physicians, at least, to be an organ. And so if we oppose organ transplantation, I suppose that we oppose blood transfusions as well. Is it living or non-living? That's a big problem. Is it an emotional issue? Well, yes, it probably is. The Old Testament talked about the bowels as the center of many activities. Today, we speak about the brain and the heart. If you don't think you're influenced by this in trying to decide this kind of issue, think about some of the popular phrases you've heard and used, and think about how they might color your distinction between a hair transplant and a heart transplant. To break one's heart, to know by heart, to do one's heart good, to eat one's heart out, from the bottom of one's heart. Having one's heart in one's mouth, the idea of dislocation. Heart and soul, losing one's heart, taking heart, that's a terrible pun, wearing one's heart on one's sleeve, with all one's heart, and have a heart. And maybe that's the one to think about, have a heart. In the end, it seems to me that this kind of intuitive argument, ethical argument, leaves us in a terribly uncomfortable position. Well, what are we left with then? It seems to me that we're left with several things that on an intuitive level really are straightforward and can be clearly enunciated, and I'd like to conclude with those. First, it appears to me at least that many of our ethical reactions are conditioned by habit and assumptions rather than by careful examination of the issues. Ethical issues are so tangled and complicated that we can't sit down and agonize, for example, over whether eyeglasses or shoes or contact lenses, etc., are prosthetic devices. We go on the basis of what we've learned, our intuitive feelings about it, and only as it becomes a recognized problem do we begin to worry about it. Now, habit and assumptions can be a very good way to deal with day-to-day activities. But for the long term, it's simply a way to be efficient enough to get the job done. And what we have to do is go back and look at those principles that go with the rules in our tangled definition of ethics. And it seems to me that when we go back, it's surprising how often the underlying assumptions aren't as frivolous as they first appear. That, in fact, there are some very good reasons for making a distinction between the two. And that what we have to be careful of is when the underlying assumptions change. And I've already said that one of the issues that I believe, after years of involvement in this particular field, drives many of the ethical discussions is cost. If it is so, it certainly is reasonable because of scarcity of resources, but it's certainly not the kind of thing where I ever expect to find in the Book of Mormon a cost breakdown analysis for a particular ethical procedure. It's certainly not, in many ways, something that deserves to be part of our theological ethics. And yet it may be a very real part of whether or not it's proper and appropriate to do something, because it affects how resources are distributed between us. And that sense of whether some can stand out, some can benefit, and others may not, may be a very proper issue for theological discussion. The other one that I would attack is the issue of naturalness. I believe that there are a few words in the English language that are tougher to define when you address them carefully. In particular, I've heard many theological objections in the area of transplantation on the issue of whether or not it is a natural thing. I submit that, as Emerson was said to have said, that common sense is exceedingly uncommon, that naturalness really depends on whether or not it's something that's common. And those things that are uncommonly done often don't seem to be natural. That's a dangerous litmus test for something that affects our well-being and those around us. Maybe a good shorthand, but when you come back to examine an ethical issue in detail, be careful of that word and make sure, I would suggest, that you know what lies behind your decision as to which side of that definition your issue lies. And finally, we must recognize the very real point of the arguments of those who worry about halfway technology and the problems with allowing innovation and change. And I think this reflects the just-finished discussion about quackery, that we cannot grow and change without enduring mistakes. And there has to be an avenue in our society for trying things when the best that we have now isn't working perfectly. Almost by definition, some of these explorations must end in failure and even injury and death. We owe a great debt to those investigators who pioneered in this new territory. I believe, certainly in people like Barney Clark and Kasparak, who was the first Stanford transplant, that there was no doubt, the evidence overwhelmingly demonstrated their commitment to this. And I remember in the case of Kasparak, Shumway would have been the first surgeon to have planted a heart in man, and were it not that he could not obtain permission from the Hospital Ethics Committee. And when Barnard was successful and public acclaim supported it, and it was recognized that the public didn't consider this an unacceptable act, opposition melted. But when they interviewed Kasparak, there were certain members of the committee who seemed to feel at that time that his mere giving of consent to a procedure which they perceived as having no hope of solving his problem demonstrated that he was not able to give informed consent, a true tautology. I was an intern at Stanford at the time, and I remember well the response that was circulated after the last meeting of this committee with Mr. Kasparak. It was reported that he said, "Gentlemen, I know that I have a limited life, and I realize that there's very little chance that I'm going to survive this. But," he said, "I want to spend what's left of my life in a way that's positive, that makes a contribution to others, and I think this will do it, and I'd like to get on with it." And I think that is an ethical position. I think it's one that we have to be careful about denying to individuals, and at the same time, as a society, we have to protect to make sure that it's given willingly and with an understanding of what they're really submitting themselves to. Because in the end, it's really true that without a degree of selflessness, even our most egocentric concerns are not well satisfied. Thank you.
Good afternoon. In my view, it is absolutely and clearly unethical to keep an audience beyond the time that they have agreed by their free will to be present. Now, according to that situation, we have 9 minutes remaining. I will strip my remarks to their bare bones and try and leave 4, maybe 3 minutes for discussion. I'm on this panel, I believe, because we want to hear also what happens to the practicing, not high IQ, ordinary LDS physician when he deals with all of these issues that we've just heard about. Now, what am I going to do when I go see my next sore throat and I've heard all this stuff? Let me suggest to you one thesis and perhaps give you a few short cases that document what I believe to be the case, and that is that the LDS physician at this point in history moves effortlessly between two contradictory modes. On the one hand, there is the mode of scientific, rational, non-influencing physician. That is what all of the current ethical statements from the Judicial Council and the American College of Physicians and that sort of thing clearly document. On the other hand, the unscientific physician prompted by the Spirit, giving blessings, converting people in the office, that is the Mormon cultural ideal. There is a profound conflict there. All of my documentation I will have to toss, but I will attempt to share with you four cases. Anyone who wants to take notes, you write case history on one side, you write issue in the middle, and you write resolution on the other side. And I think you'll see there's an interesting problem here. Case one, I'm a third-year medical student at Stanford again, 1965. I am the gump on the ward. I draw blood. I am the scut boy. I wear this little white coat. I don't know anything. I leave the ward on Friday afternoon and notice this cute nurse with blonde hair. It's kind of curly. On Sunday afternoon, I return in a dark suit with another person in a dark suit. I have a vial of oil. I announce that I am on this ward to heal somebody and that I, in fact, am a minister. Everything moves out of my way, and I'm ushered into the room of a patient who is critically ill, who's had a craniotomy, who is practically brain dead. The cute nurse, and of course it's the same cute nurse, is pumping up the blood pressure cuff every 5 minutes, and she's not even sure we can bless this person between her efforts to keep the blood pressure up. And she looks at me and says, "What are you?" I realized there was some conflict there. Now, she was not smart enough to be able to quote the principles of medical ethics of that era, the third section. And that section reads, "A physician should practice a method of healing founded on a scientific basis, and he should not voluntarily associate professionally with anyone who violates that principle." And it was perfectly clear what I was doing there with my little bottle of oil. Now, how do we resolve that? Well, have I crossed the line over to Dr. Leach's herbal cure that you saw in Dr. Smith's covered wagon picture of the Orem 54th Ward? Well, fortunately, the chiropractors have sued the AMA since that time, and that has been struck out. And now I can associate with quacks all I want, including my brethren with the oil, as long as they do no harm. And that's not because there's been a change within the AMA, that's because there's been a change legally within what, in fact, can be done. So how does a physician resolve this? Well, one thing he does is that when he blesses people, he doesn't record that in the chart. I can't tell you how important that is. This afternoon, I pulled a piece of meat out of somebody's esophagus with a scope, and the nurse threw it away, and I went down in the garbage can to get that piece of meat out to measure it. How big was it? What did it look like? It had rice on it. It looked awful. But the important thing was that I cared to record that. The Mormon physician does not record the blessing in the chart. He does not study the nature of blessings altogether, though it would be perfectly easy to design a double-blind controlled clinical trial that would test this out very nicely. He specifically, in the Melchizedek Priesthood Handbook, is enjoined that he cannot offer a blessing to a sick patient, because it says that in D&C 24. You have to wait until they offer it to you. And he is profoundly critical of other non-scientific practitioners, in fact being a non-scientific practitioner himself. Very important to understand there's a little dilemma there. And as we glide from one mode of being to another, only a few of us stub our toes. So that was a story about blessing. The issue was belief in the non-scientific method of healing, and the mode of dealing with that is to live in compartments, do not study, do not act on the information from the blessing. Do these two separate things and go your way. I blessed somebody last Sunday. It was a patient of mine. It was really weird. You know, I do this all the time, and it still bothers me. Okay, second story relates to another major ethical problem, and that is patient from my practice moves into my ward. I am the eldest quorum president and the home teacher. I do home teaching in the office as the last part of the office visit, because the patient will certainly not having to do with home teachers in their home. The bishop wants to know what's the scoop on this person. Mormon cultural ethics, you tell. you tell the ward council everything you know. Or at the very least, when the state president wants to know it, the eldest quorum president, you tell him. Medical ethics, very clear from the time of Hippocrates, that confidence is as absolute as you can make it. This has been once again diluted by the law, and the law now states that that there are certain legal situations in which you've got to report things, including venereal disease and accidents and people who are liable to kill other people. But the issue of confidentiality is managed by the Mormon physician in column 3 by working in two systems. For religious interviews, it's not complete. For office interviews, it's complete unless the law tells you you're stuck. This is a situation where we as a church could do a lot better. Third issue, single 28-year-old diabetic female who I'm covering someone else's practice. She comes to see me. She has terrible acidosis. She ends up in the hospital. I do a pregnancy test. She is pregnant. She announces, I will not have this baby. You, doctor, are going to find for me a way to get this abortion done legally, or I'll go out on the street and get it. And even though my diabetes is bad, that is tough. On the one hand, the medical ethical situation is very clear. The American College of Physicians had an ad hoc committee last year, and they said you must not influence the patient, particularly on the issue of abortion, because there's been a big hassle about that. The Christian, at least the Catholic and Mormon attitude, has been quite different, and that is that you at least say to her, you sure this is okay, lady?
That's a nice way to end the session here, and I'd like to thank all of you for your participation and the panelists for their excellent presentations. Thank you.